And if I did, what's wrong with that? In itself, nothing. But in setting up so large and widespread and prolonged a celebration, were we not advertising to the rather unstable and suspicious men of the junta that Harry was too popular and might be a danger to them? No one could possibly believe such a thing was in my mind, Doris said. I am merely pointing out the possibility. In planning the birthday celebration, you insisted that the central offices be cleared out. Temporarily, for obvious reasons. And insisted that they remain totally unoccupied for a while. No work was done, except by Hugo Amaril, during that time. I didn't think it would hurt if the maestro had some rest in advance of the party. Surely you can't complain about that. But it meant that you could consult with other people in the empty offices, and do so in total privacy. The offices are, of course, well shielded. I did consult there, with your daughter-in-law, with caterers, suppliers, and other tradesmen. It was absolutely necessary, wouldn't you say? And if one of those you consulted with was a member of the junta? Hilar looked as though Doris had hit him. I resent that, Dr. Venabili. What do you take me for? Doris did not answer directly. She said, You went on to talk to Dr. Selden about his forthcoming meeting with the general, and urged him, rather pressingly, to let you take his place and run the risks that might follow. The result was, of course, that Dr. Selden insisted rather vehemently on seeing the general himself, which one can argue was precisely what you wanted him to do. Hilar emitted a short, nervous laugh. With all due respect, this does sound like paranoia, Doctor. Doris pressed on. And then, after the party, it was you, wasn't it, who was the first to suggest that a group of us go to the Dome's Edge Hotel? Yes, and I remember you saying it was a good idea. Might it not have been suggested in order to make the junta uneasy, as yet another example of Harry's popularity? And might it not have been arranged to tempt me into invading the palace grounds? Could I have stopped you? Said Hilar, his incredulity giving way to anger. You had made up your own mind about that. Doris paid no attention. And of course, you hoped that by entering the palace grounds, I might make sufficient trouble to turn the junta even further against Harry. But why, Dr. Venabili, why would I be doing this? One might say it was to get rid of Dr. Selden and to succeed him as director of the project. How can you possibly think this of me? I can't believe you are serious. You're just doing what you said you would at the start of this exercise, just showing me what can be done by an ingenious mind intent on finding so-called evidence. Let's turn to something else. I said that you were in a position to use the empty rooms for private conversations, and that you may have been there with a member of the junta. That is not even worth a denial. But you were overheard. A little girl wandered into the room, curled up in a chair out of sight, and overheard your conversation. Hilar frowned. What did she hear? She reported that two men were talking about death. She was only a child and could not repeat anything in detail. But two words did impress her, and they were lemonade death. Now you seem to be changing from fantasy to, if you'll excuse me, madness. What can lemonade death mean, and what would it have to do with me? My first thought was to take it literally. The girl in question is very fond of lemonade, and there was a good deal of it at the party, but no one had poisoned it. Thanks for granting sanity that much. Then I realized the girl had heard something else, which her imperfect command of the language and her love of the beverage had perverted into lemonade. And have you invented a distortion? Ilar snorted. It did seem to me for a while that what she might have heard was layman-aided death. What does that mean? An assassination carried through by laymen, by non-mathematicians. Doris stopped and frowned. Her hand clutched her chest. Ilar said with sudden concern, Is something wrong, Dr. Van Abbele? No, said Doris, seeming to shake herself. For a few moments she said nothing further, and Ilar cleared his throat. There was no sign of amusement on his face any longer as he said, Your comments, Dr. Van Abbele, are growing steadily more ridiculous, and, well, I don't care if I do offend you, but I have grown tired of them. Shall we put an end to this? We are almost at an end, Dr. Ilar. Layman-aided may indeed be ridiculous, as you say. I had decided that in my own mind, too. You are, in part, responsible for the development of the electroclarifier, aren't you? Ilar seemed to stand straighter as he said, with a touch of pride, Entirely responsible. Surely not entirely. I understand it was designed by Cinda Monet. A designer. She followed my instructions. A layman. The electroclarifier is a layman-aided device. With suppressed violence, Ilar said, I don't think I want to hear that phrase again. Once more, shall we put an end to this? Doris forged on as if she hadn't heard his request. Though you give her no credit now, you gave Cinda credit to her face, to keep her working eagerly, I suppose. She said you gave her credit, and she was very grateful because of it. She said you even called the device by her name and yours, though that's not the official name. Of course not. It's the electroclarifier. And she said she was designing improvements, intensifiers and so on, and that you had the prototype of an advanced version of the new device for testing. What has all this to do with anything? Since Dr. Selden and Dr. Amaril have been working with the electroclarifier, both have in some ways deteriorated. Hugo, who works with it more, has also suffered more. The electroclarifier can in no way do that kind of damage. Doris put her hand to her forehead and momentarily winced. She said, And now you have a more intense electroclarifier that might do more damage, that might kill quickly rather than slowly. Absolute nonsense. Now consider the name of the device, a name which, according to the woman who designed it, you are the only one to use. I presume you called it the Ilar Monet Clarifier. I don't ever recall using that phrase, said Ilar uneasily. Surely you did. And the new intensified Ilar Monet Clarifier could be used to kill with no blame to be attached to anyone. Just a sad accident through a new and untried device. It would be the Ilar Monet death, and a little girl heard it as lemonade death. Dora's hand groped at her side. Ilar said softly, You are not well, Dr. Van Abbele. I am perfectly well. Am I not correct? Look, it doesn't matter what you can twist into lemonade. Who knows what the little girl may have heard? It all boils down to the deadliness of the electroclarifier. Bring me into court, or before a scientific investigating board, and let experts, as many as you like, check the effect of the electroclarifier, even the new intensified one, on human beings. They will find it has no measurable effect. I don't believe that, muttered Venevoli. Her hands were now at her forehead, and her eyes were closed. She swayed slightly. Ilar said, It is clear that you are not well, Dr. Venevoli. Perhaps that means it is my turn to talk. May I? Dora's eyes opened, and she simply stared. I'll take your silence for consent, Doctor. Of what use would it be for me to try to get rid of Dr. Selden and Dr. Amaryl in order to take my place as director? You would prevent any attempt I made at assassination, as you now think you are doing. In the unlikely case that I succeeded in such a project and was rid of the two great men, you would tear me to pieces afterward. You're a very unusual woman, strong and fast beyond belief, and while you are alive, the maestro is safe. Yes, said Dors, glowering. I told this to the men of the junta. Why should they not consult me on matters involving the project? They are very interested in psychohistory, as well they ought to be. It was difficult for them to believe what I told them about you, until you made your foray into the palace grounds. That convinced them, you can be sure, and they agreed with my plan. Aha! Now we come to it, Doris said weakly. I told you the electroclarifier cannot harm human beings. It cannot. Amaryl and your precious Harry are just getting old, though you refuse to accept it. So what? They are fine, perfectly human. The electromagnetic field has no effect of any importance on organic materials. Of course, it may have adverse effects on sensitive electromagnetic machinery, and if we could imagine a human being built of metal and electronics, it might have an effect on it. Legends tell us of such artificial human beings. The Mycogenians have based their religion on them, and they call such beings robots. If there were such a thing as a robot, one would imagine it would be stronger and faster by far than an ordinary human being, that it would have properties, in fact, resembling those you have, Dr. Venabile. And such a robot could, indeed, be stopped, hurt, even destroyed by an intense electroclarifier, such as the one that I have here, one that has been operating at low energy since we began our conversation. That is why you are feeling ill, Dr. Venabile, and for the first time in your existence, I'm sure. Doris said nothing, merely stared at the man. Slowly, she sank into a chair. Ilar smiled and went on. Of course, with you taken care of, there will be no problem with the maestro and with Amaryl. The maestro, in fact, without you, may fade out at once and resign in grief, while Amaryl is merely a child in his mind. In all likelihood, neither will have to be killed. How does it feel, Dr. Venabile, to be unmasked after all these years? I must admit, you were very good at concealing your true nature. It's almost surprising that no one else discovered the truth before now. But then, I am a brilliant mathematician, an observer, a thinker, a deducer. Even I would not have figured it out, were it not for your fanatical devotion to the maestro, and the occasional bursts of superhuman power you seemed to summon at will when he was threatened. Say goodbye, Dr. Venabile. All I have to do now is to turn the device to full power, and you will be history. Doris seemed to collect herself and rose slowly from her seat, mumbling, "I may be better shielded than you think." Then, with a grunt, she threw herself at Ilar. Ilar, his eyes widening, shrieked and reeled back. Then Doris was on him, her hand flashing. Its side struck Ilar's neck, smashing the vertebrae and shattering the nerve cord. He fell dead on the floor. Doris straightened with an effort and staggered toward the door. She had to find Harry. He had to know what had happened. Chapter 27. Harry Seldon rose from his seat in horror. He had never seen Doris look so. Her face twisted, her body canted, staggering as though she were drunk. "Doris, what happened? What's wrong?" He ran to her and grasped her around the waist, even as her body gave way and collapsed in his arms. He lifted her. She weighed more than an ordinary woman her size would have, but Seldon was unaware of that at the moment, and placed her on the couch. "What happened?" he said. She told him, gasping, her voice breaking now and then while he cradled her head and tried to force himself to believe what was happening. "Ilar is dead," she said. "I finally killed a human being. First time. Makes it worse." "How badly are you damaged, Doris?" "Badly. Ilar turned on his device, full, when I rushed him." "You can be readjusted." "How? There's no one on Trantor who knows how. I need Daniil." Daniil. Demerzel. Somehow, deep inside, Harry had always known. His friend, a robot, had provided him with a protector, a robot, to ensure that psychohistory and the seeds of the foundations were given a chance to take root. The only problem was, Harry had fallen in love with his protector, a robot. It all made sense now. All the nagging doubts and the questions could be answered. And somehow it didn't matter one bit. All that mattered was Doris. "We can't let this happen." "It must." Doris' eyes fluttered open and looked at Seldon. "Must. Tried to save you, but missed. Vital point. Who will protect you now?" Seldon couldn't see her clearly. There was something wrong with his eyes. "Don't worry about me, Doris. It's you. It's you." "No. You, Harry. Tell Manella. Manella, I forgive her now. She did better than I. Explain to Wanda. You and Rach, take care of each other." "No, no, no," said Seldon, rocking back and forth. "You can't do this. Hang on, Doris, please. Please, my love." Doris' head shook feebly, and she smiled even more feebly. "Goodbye, Harry, my love. Remember always all you did for me." "I did nothing for you." "You loved me, and your love made me human." Her eyes remained open, but Doris had ceased functioning. Hugo Amaril came storming into Seldon's office. "Harry, the riots are beginning. Sooner and harder even than and then he stared at Selden and Doors and whispered, "What happened?" Selden looked up at him in agony. "Riots? What do I care about riots now? What do I care about anything now?" Part 4. Wanda Selden. Selden, Wanda. In the waning years of Harry Selden's life, he grew most attached to, some say dependent upon, his granddaughter Wanda. Orphaned in her teens, Wanda Selden devoted herself to her grandfather's psychohistory project, filling the vacancy left by Hugo Amaril. The content of Wanda Selden's work remains largely a mystery, for it was conducted in virtually total isolation. The only individuals allowed access to Wanda Selden's research were Harry himself and a young man named Stettin Palver, whose descendant Preem would, 400 years later, contribute to the rebirth of Trantor as the planet rose from the ashes of the Great Sack, 300 FE. Although the full extent of Wanda Selden's contribution to the Foundation is unknown, it was undoubtedly of the greatest magnitude. Encyclopedia Galactica. Chapter 1. Harry Selden walked into the Galactic Library, limping a little as he did more and more often these days, and made for the banks of skitters, the little vehicles that slid their way along the interminable corridors of the building complex. He was held up, however, by the sight of three men seated at one of the galactography alcoves, with the galactograph showing the galaxy in full three-dimensional representation. And, of course, its worlds slowly pinwheeling around its core, spinning at right angles to that as well. From where Selden stood, he could see that the border province of Anacreon was marked off in glowing red. It skirted the edge of the galaxy and took up a great volume, but it was sparsely populated with stars. Anacreon was not remarkable for either wealth or culture, but was remarkable for its distance from Trantor, 10,000 parsecs away. Selden, acting on impulse, took a seat at a computer console near the three, and set up a random search he was sure would take an indefinite period. Some instinct told him that such an intense interest in Anacreon must be political in nature. Its position in the galaxy made it one of the least secure holdings of the current imperial regime. His eyes remained on his screen, but Selden's ears were open for the discussion near him. One didn't usually hear political discussions in the library. They were, in point of fact, not supposed to take place. Selden did not know any of the three men. That was not entirely surprising. There were habitués of the library, quite a few, and Selden knew most of them by sight, and some even to talk to. But the library was open to all citizens. No qualifications. Anyone could enter and use its facilities. For a limited period of time, of course, only a select few, like Selden, were allowed to set up shop in the library. Selden had been granted the use of a locked private office and complete access to library resources. One of the men, Selden thought of him as Hooknose for obvious reasons, spoke in a low, urgent voice. "Let it go," he said. "Let it go. It's costing us a mint to try to hold on, and even if we do, it will only be while they're there. They can't stay there forever, and as soon as they leave, the situation will revert to what it was." Selden knew what they were talking about. The news had come over Trantor Vision only 3 days ago that the Imperial government had decided on a show of force to bring the obstreperous governor of Anacreon into line. Selden's own psychohistorical analysis had shown him that it was a useless procedure, but the government did not generally listen when its emotions were stirred. Selden smiled slightly and grimly at hearing Hooknose say what he himself had said, and the young man said it without the benefit of any knowledge of psychohistory. Hooknose went on. If we leave Anacreon alone, what do we lose? It's still there, right where it always was, right at the edge of the Empire. It can't pick up and go to Andromeda, can it? So it still has to trade with us, and life continues. What's the difference if they salute the Emperor or not? You'll never be able to tell the difference. The second man, whom Selden had labeled Baldy, for even more obvious reasons, said, Except this whole business doesn't exist in a vacuum. If Anacreon goes, the other border provinces will go. The Empire will break up. So what? Whispered Hooknose fiercely. The Empire can't run itself effectively anymore anyway. It's too big. Let the border go and take care of itself, if it can. The inner worlds will be all the stronger and better off. The border doesn't have to be ours politically. It will still be ours economically. And now the third man, Red Cheeks, said, I wish you were right, but that's not the way it's going to work. If the border provinces establish their independence, the first thing each will do will be to try to increase its power at the expense of its neighbors. There'll be war and conflict, and every one of the governors will dream of becoming emperor at last. It'll be like the old days before the kingdom of Trantor, a dark age that will last for thousands of years. Baldy said, Surely things won't be that bad. The Empire may break up, but it will heal itself quickly when people find out that the breakup just means war and impoverishment. They'll look back on the golden days of the intact Empire, and all will be well again. We're not barbarians, you know. We'll find a way. Absolutely, said Hooknose. We've got to remember that the Empire has faced crisis after crisis in its history, and has pulled through time and again. But Red Cheek shook his head as he said, This is not just another crisis. This is something much worse. The Empire has been deteriorating for generations. 10 years' worth of the junta destroyed the economy. And since the fall of the junta and the rise of this new emperor, the Empire has been so weak that the governors on the periphery don't have to do anything. It's going to fall of its own weight. And the allegiance to the Emperor, began Hooknose. What allegiance? Said Red Cheeks. We went for years without an emperor after Cleon was assassinated, and no one seemed to mind much. And this new emperor is just a figurehead. There's nothing he can do. There's nothing anyone can do. This isn't a crisis. This is the end. The other two stared at Red Cheeks, frowning. Baldy said, You really believe it? You think that the Imperial government will just sit there and let it all happen? Yes. Like you two, they won't believe it is happening. That is, until it's too late.
What would you want them to do if they did believe it? Asked Baldy.
Red Cheeks stared into the galactograph as if he might find an answer there. I don't know. Look, in due course of time, I'll die. Things won't be too bad by then. Afterward, as the situation gets worse, other people can worry about it. I'll be gone. And so will the good old days. Maybe forever. I'm not the only one who thinks this, by the way. Ever hear of someone named Harry Selden?
Sure, said Hooknose at once. Wasn't he First Minister under Cleon?
Yes, said Red Cheeks. He's some sort of scientist.
I heard him give a talk a few months back. It felt good to know I'm not the only one who believes the empire is falling apart. He said
everything's going to pot and there's going to be a permanent dark age?
Baldy interjected. Well, no, said Red Cheeks. He's one of these real cautious types. He says it might happen, but he's wrong. It will happen.
Selden had heard enough. He limped toward the table where the three men sat and touched Red Cheeks on the shoulder.
Sir, he said, may I speak to you for a moment?
Startled, Red Cheeks looked up, and then he said, Hey, aren't you Professor Selden?
I always have been, said Selden.
He handed the man a reference tile bearing his photograph. I would like to see you here in my library office at 4 p.m. day after tomorrow. Can you manage that?
I have to work.
Call in sick if you have to. It's important.
Well, I'm not sure, sir.
Do it, said Selden. If you get into any sort of trouble over it, I'll straighten it out. And meanwhile, gentlemen, do you mind if I study the galaxy simulation for a moment? It's been a long time since I've looked at one.
They nodded mutely, apparently abashed at being in the presence of a former First Minister.
One by one, the men stepped back and allowed Selden access to the galactograph controls. Selden's finger reached out to the controls, and the red that had marked off the province of Anacreon vanished. The galaxy was unmarked, a glowing pinwheel of mist brightening into the spherical glow at the center, behind which was the galactic black hole. Individual stars could not be made out, of course, unless the view were magnified. But then, only one portion or another of the galaxy would be shown on the screen, and Selden wanted to see the whole thing, to get a look at the empire that was vanishing. He pushed a contact, and a series of yellow dots appeared on the galactic image. They represented the habitable planets, 25 million of them. They could be distinguished as individual dots in the thin fog that represented the outskirts of the galaxy, but they were more and more thickly placed as one moved in toward the center. There was a belt of what seemed solid yellow, but which would separate into individual dots under magnification, around the central glow. The central glow itself remained white and unmarked, of course. No habitable planets could exist in the midst of the turbulent energies of the core. Despite the great density of yellow, not one star in 10,000 Selden knew had a habitable planet circling it. This was true despite the planet molding and terraforming capacities of humanity. Not all the molding in the galaxy could make most of the worlds into anything a human being could walk on in comfort and without the protection of a spacesuit. Selden closed another contact. The yellow dots disappeared, but one tiny region glowed blue. Trentor and the various worlds directly dependent on it. As close as it could be to the central core, and yet remaining insulated from its deadliness, it was commonly viewed as being located at the center of the galaxy, which it wasn't, not truly. As usual, one had to be impressed by the smallness of the world of Trentor, a tiny place in the vast realm of the galaxy. But within it was squeezed the largest concentration of wealth, culture, and governmental authority that humanity had ever seen. And even that was doomed to destruction. It was almost as though the men could read his mind, or perhaps they interpreted the sad expression on his face. Baldy asked softly, Is the Empire really going to be destroyed? Selden replied, softer still,
It might. It might. Anything might happen.
He rose, smiled at the men, and left. But in his thoughts he screamed, "It will. It will."
Chapter 2 Selden sighed as he climbed into one of the skitters that were ranked side by side in the large alcove. There had been a time, just a few years ago, when he had gloried in walking briskly along the interminable corridors of the library, telling himself that even though he was past 60, he could manage it. But now, at 70, his legs gave way all too quickly, and he had to take a skitter. Younger men took them all the time because skitters saved them trouble. But Selden did it because he had to, and that made all the difference. After Selden punched in, the chief librarian was a compound of dignity always, and the question might have seemed offensive. "Greetings," said Selden. Senov had a gray beard, rather more than halfway to white, and he wore a pure white hat. Selden understood that without any explanation. It was a case of reverse ostentation. The total absence of color represented the highest peak of position. Zenov rubbed his hands with what seemed to be an inner glee.
"I've called you in, Harry, because I've got good news for you. We've found it."
"By it, Lass, you mean?"
"A suitable world. You wanted one far out. I think we've located the ideal one."
His smile broadened.
"You just leave it to the library, Harry. We can find anything."
"I have no doubt, Lass. Tell me about this world."
"Well, let me show you its location first."
A section of the wall slid aside, the lights in the room dimmed, and the galaxy appeared in three-dimensional form, turning slowly. Again, red lines marked off the province of Anacreon, so that Selden could almost swear that the episode with the three men had been a rehearsal for this. And then a brilliant blue dot appeared at the far end of the province.
"There it is," said Zenov. "It's an ideal world. Sizable, well-watered, good oxygen atmosphere, vegetation, of course. A great deal of sea life. It's there just for the taking. No planet molding or terraforming required, or at least none that cannot be done while it is actually occupied."
Selden said, "Is it an unoccupied world, Lass?"
"Absolutely unoccupied. No one on it."
"But why, if it's so suitable? I presume that if you have all the details about it, it must have been explored. Why wasn't it colonized?"
"It was explored, but only by unmanned probes, and there was no colonization, presumably because it was so far from everything. The planet revolves around a star that is farther from the central black hole than that of any inhabited planet, farther by far. Too far, I suppose, for prospective colonists, but I think not too far for you. You said, the farther the better."
"Yes," said Selden, nodding. "I still say so. Does it have a name, or is there just a letter-number combination?"
"Believe it or not, it has a name. Those who sent out the probes named it Terminus, an archaic word meaning the end of the line, which it would seem to be."
Selden said, "Is the world part of the territory of the province of Anacreon?"
"Not really," said Zenov. "If you'll study the red line and the red shading, you will see that the blue dot of Terminus lies slightly outside it. 50 light years outside it, in fact. Terminus belongs to nobody. It's not even part of the Empire, as a matter of fact."
"You're right then, Lass. It does seem like the ideal world I've been looking for.
Of course, said Zenov thoughtfully. Once you occupy Terminus, I imagine the governor of Anacreon will claim it as being under his jurisdiction.
That's possible, said Selden. But we'll have to deal with that when the matter comes up.
Zenov rubbed his hands again.
What a glorious conception! Setting up a huge project on a brand new world, far away and entirely isolated, so that year by year and decade by decade, a huge encyclopedia of all human knowledge can be put together, an epitome of what is present in this library. If I were only younger, I would love to join the expedition.
Selden said sadly, You're almost 20 years younger than I am. Almost everyone is far younger than I am, he thought, even more sadly.
Zenov said, Ah, yes, I heard that you just passed your 70th birthday. I hope you enjoyed it and celebrated appropriately.
Selden stirred. I don't celebrate my birthdays.
Oh, but you did. I remember the famous story of your 60th birthday.
Selden felt the pain as deeply as though the dearest loss in all the world had taken place the day before. Please don't talk about it, he said.
Abashed, Zenov said, I'm sorry. We'll talk about something else. If indeed Terminus is the world you want, I imagine that your work on the preliminaries to the Encyclopedia project will be redoubled. As you know, the library will be glad to help you in all respects.
I'm aware of it, Lass, and I am endlessly grateful. We will indeed keep working. He rose, not yet able to smile after the sharp pang induced by the reference to his birthday celebration of 10 years back. He said, So I must go to continue my labors. And as he left, he felt, as always, a pang of conscience over the deceit he was practicing. Lass Zenov did not have the slightest idea of Selden's true intentions. Chapter 3 Harry Selden surveyed the comfortable suite that had been his personal office at the Galactic Library these past few years. It, like the rest of the library, had a vague air of decay about it, a kind of weariness, something that had been too long in one place. And yet Selden knew it might remain here in the same place for centuries more, with judicious rebuildings, for millennia even. How did he come to be here? Over and over again he felt the past in his mind, ran his mental tendrils along the line of development of his life. It was part of growing older, no doubt. There was so much more in the past, so much less in the future, that the mind turned away from the looming shadow ahead to contemplate the safety of what had gone before. In his case, though, there was that change. For over 30 years, psychohistory had developed in what might almost be considered a straight line, progress creepingly slow but moving straight ahead. Then, 6 years ago, there had been a right-angled turn, totally unexpected. And Selden knew exactly how it had happened, how a concatenation of events came together to make it possible. It was Wanda, of course, Selden's granddaughter. Harry closed his eyes and settled into his chair to review the events of 6 years before. 12-year-old Wanda was bereft. Her mother, Manella, had had another child, another little girl, Velis. And for a time, the new baby was a total preoccupation. Her father, Rach, having finished his book on his home sector of Dahl, found it to be a minor success and himself a minor celebrity. He was called upon to talk on the subject, something he accepted with alacrity, for he was fiercely absorbed in the subject, and, as he said to Harry with a grin, When I talk about Dahl, I don't have to hide my Dahlite accent. In fact, the public expects it of me.
The net result, though, was that he was away from home a considerable amount of time, and when he wasn't, it was the baby he wanted to see. As for Doris, Doris was gone, and to Harry Seldon that wound was ever fresh, ever painful. And he had reacted to it in an unfortunate manner. It had been Wanda's dream that had set in motion the current of events that had ended with the loss of Doris. Wanda had had nothing to do with it, Seldon knew that very well. And yet he found himself shrinking from her, so that he also failed her in the crisis brought about by the birth of the new baby. And Wanda wandered disconsolately to the one person who always seemed glad to see her, the one person she could always count on. That was Hugo Amaril, second only to Harry Seldon in the development of psychohistory, and first in his absolute round-the-clock devotion to it. Harry had had Doris and Rach. But psychohistory was Hugo's life. He had no wife and children. Yet whenever Wanda came into his presence, something within him recognized her as a child, and he dimly felt, for just that moment, a sense of loss that seemed to be assuaged only by showing the child affection. To be sure, he tended to treat her as a rather undersized adult, but Wanda seemed to like that. It was 6 years ago that she had wandered into Hugo's office. Hugo looked up at her with his owlish, reconstituted eyes, and as usual took a moment or two to recognize her. Then he said, "Why, it's my dear friend Wanda. But why do you look so sad? Surely an attractive young woman like you should never feel sad." And Wanda, her lower lip trembling, said, "Nobody loves me." "Oh, come, that's not true." "They just love that new baby. They don't care about me anymore."
"I love you, Wanda."
"Well, you're the only one, then, Uncle Hugo." And even though she could no longer crawl onto his lap, as she had when she was younger, she cradled her head on his shoulder and wept. Amaril, totally unaware of what he should do, could only hug the girl and say, "Don't cry. Don't cry." And out of sheer sympathy, and because he had so little in his own life to weep about, he found that tears were trickling down his own cheeks as well. And then he said with sudden energy, "Wanda, would you like to see something pretty?"
"What?" sniffled Wanda.
Amaril knew only one thing in life and the universe that was pretty. He said, "Did you ever see the prime radiant?"
"No. What is it?"
"It's what your grandfather and I use to do our work. See, it's right here." He pointed to the black cube on his desk, and Wanda looked at it woefully.
"That's not pretty," she said.
"Not now," agreed Amaril. "But watch when I turn it on." He did so. The room darkened and filled with dots of light and flashes of different colors. "See? Now we can magnify it so all the dots become mathematical symbols." And so they did. There seemed a rush of material toward them, and there in the air were signs of all sorts, letters, numbers, arrows, and shapes that Wanda had never seen before.
"Isn't it pretty?" asked Amaril.
"Yes, it is," said Wanda, staring carefully at the equations that, she didn't know, represented possible futures. "I don't like that part, though. I think it's wrong."
She pointed at a colorful equation to her left. "Wrong? Why do you say it's wrong?" said Amaril, frowning.
"Because it's not pretty. I'd do it a different way."
Amaril cleared his throat.
"Well, I'll try to fix it up."
And he moved closer to the equation in question, staring at it in his owlish fashion. Wanda said,
Thank you very much, Uncle Hugo, for showing me your pretty lights. Maybe someday I'll understand what they mean.
That's all right, said Amaryl. I hope you feel better.
A little, thanks.
And after flashing the briefest of smiles, she left the room. Amaryl stood there, feeling a trifle hurt. He didn't like having the Prime Radiance product criticized, not even by a 12-year-old girl who knew no better. And as he stood there, he had no idea whatsoever that the psychohistorical revolution had begun. Chapter 4. That afternoon, Amaryl went to Harry Seldon's office at Streeling University. That in itself was unusual, for Amaryl virtually never left his own office, even to speak with a colleague just down the hall.
Harry, said Amaryl, frowning and looking puzzled, something very odd has happened, very peculiar.
Seldon looked at Amaryl with deepest sorrow. He was only 53, but he looked much older, bent, worn down to almost transparency. When forced, he had undergone doctor's examinations, and the doctors had all recommended that he leave his work for a period of time, some said permanently, and rest. Only this, the doctors said, might improve his health. Otherwise, Seldon shook his head. Take him away from his work, and he'll die all the sooner and unhappier. We have no choice. And then Seldon realized that, lost in such thoughts, he was not hearing Amaryl speak. He said, I'm sorry, Hugo, I'm a little distracted. Begin again. Amaryl said, I'm telling you that something very odd has happened. Very peculiar. What is it, Hugo? It was Wanda. She came in to see me, very sad, very upset. Why? Apparently, it's the new baby. Oh, yes, Harry said, with more than a trace of guilt in his voice. So she said, and cried on my shoulder. I actually cried a bit too, Harry. And then I thought I'd cheer her up by showing her the Prime Radiant. Here Amaryl hesitated, as if choosing his next words carefully. Go on, Hugo. What happened?
Well, she stared at all the lights, and I magnified a portion, actually section 42R254. You're acquainted with that?
Seldon smiled. No, Hugo. I haven't memorized the equations quite as well as you have.
Well, you should, said Amaryl severely. How can you do a good job if...
But never mind that. What I'm trying to say is that Wanda pointed to a part of it and said it was no good. It wasn't pretty.
Why not? We all have our personal likes and dislikes.
Yes, of course. But I brooded about it, and I spent some time going over it. And, Harry, there was something wrong with it. The programming was inexact, and that area, the precise area to which Wanda pointed, was no good. And really, it wasn't pretty.
Seldon sat up rather stiffly, frowning. Let me get this straight, Hugo. She pointed to something at random. Said it was no good, and she was right?
Yes, she pointed, but it wasn't at random. She was very deliberate.
But that's impossible.
But it happened. I was there.
I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm saying it was just a wild coincidence.
Is it? Do you think, with all your knowledge of psychohistory, you could take one glance at a new set of equations and tell me that one portion is no good?
Seldon said, Well then, Hugo, how did you come to expand that particular portion of the equations?
What made you choose that piece for magnification?
Emeril shrugged. That was coincidence, if you like. I just fiddled with the controls.
That couldn't be coincidence, muttered Selden. For a few moments he was lost in thought. Then he asked the question that pushed forward the psychohistorical revolution that Wanda had begun. He said, Hugo, did you have any suspicions about those equations beforehand? Did you have any reason to believe there was something wrong with them?
Emeril fiddled with the sash of his unisuit and seemed embarrassed. Yes, I think I did. You see...
You think you did?
I know I did. I seem to recall when I was setting it up. It's a new section, you know. My fingers seemed to glitch on the programmer. It looked all right then, but I guess I kept worrying about it inside. I remember thinking it looked wrong, but I had other things to do and I just let it go. But then, when Wanda happened to point to precisely the area I had been concerned about, I decided to check up on her. Otherwise, I would just have let it go as a childish statement.
And you turned on that very fragment of the equations to show Wanda, as though it were haunting your unconscious mind.
Emeril shrugged. Who knows?
And just before that, you were very close together, hugging, both crying.
Emeril shrugged again, looking even more embarrassed.
Selden said, I think I know what happened, Hugo. Wanda read your mind.
Emeril jumped as though he had been bitten.
That's impossible. Slowly, Selden said, I once knew someone who had unusual mental powers of that sort. And he thought sadly of Ato Demerzel, or, as Selden had secretly known him, Daniil. Only he was somewhat more than human. But his ability to read minds, to sense other people's thoughts, to persuade people to act in a certain way, that was a mental ability. I think somehow that perhaps Wanda has that ability as well.
I can't believe it, said Emeril stubbornly.
I can, said Selden, but I don't know what to do about it. Dimly, he felt the rumblings of a revolution in psychohistorical research, but only dimly.
Chapter 5
Dad, said Rach with some concern, you look tired.
I dare say, said Harry Selden. I feel tired. But how are you?
Rach was 44 now, and his hair was beginning to show a bit of gray. But his mustache remained thick and dark and very doll-like in appearance. Selden wondered if he touched it up with dye, but it would have been the wrong thing to ask. Selden said, Are you through with your lecturing for a while?
For a while, not for long. And I'm glad to be home and see the baby and Manella and Wanda and you, Dad.
Thank you. But I have news for you, Rach. No more lecturing. I'm going to need you here.
Rach frowned. What for?
On two different occasions, he had been sent to carry out delicate missions, but those were back during the days of the Joranumite menace. As far as he knew, things were quiet now, especially with the overthrow of the junta and the reestablishment of a pale emperor.
It's Wanda, said Selden.
Wanda? What's wrong with Wanda?
Nothing's wrong with her, but we're going to have to work out a complete genome for her, and for you and Manella as well, and eventually for the new baby.
For Bellis, too,
What's going on?
Selden hesitated. Rach, you know that your mother and I always thought there was something